You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Dyron Hamlin on the subject, The Big Picture, Faith-Boosting Evidence for the Why of All Things. This class is titled, Cultural.
My mother likes to get me t-shirts that are expressive, so this one relates to class today in that I work with a PhD rocket scientist, literally. He studied rocket science. I work with a couple of certified industrial hygienists. That's people that keep workplaces safe. I work with a number of just fantastic people. And it occurs to me that I cannot do anything by myself. If you really step back and think about your life, nobody can do anything by themselves. In fact, none of these classes at all or anything I've said this week did I do anywhere near by myself, because I'm no rocket surgeon. I can't even get the saying right. I'd like to start off in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And I mentioned earlier in the week, too, that something I used to be better at was having clarity of thought. You know, life makes so much sense when you're like 18. And everything fits into a nice, neat puzzle. And I used to love to just muse over this verse. And let's start in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1. And I'll point out the verse that I really like. It says, "When I came to you, my brothers, to preach God's secret truth, I did not use big words and great learning. For while I was with you, I made up my mind to forget everything except Jesus Christ, and especially his death on the cross." I like the way the King James reads is, "I determined to know nothing save Jesus Christ and him crucified." That's a tall order. The bite that we're trying to take off today is to talk about faith-boosting evidence in our developments, in the development of cultures around the world, that God's way is the best way. We wrapped up yesterday sort of musing historically about the kingdoms, what I would say is, to sum up, is kind of the kingdoms of men versus the kingdom of God. And Brother John came up afterwards and pointed out that there in Daniel 4, yes, Nebuchadnezzar was a tyrant. Yes, he was a horrible, treacherous leader. But in reality, what he was condemned for was his pride. And therein lies the root cause, sort of the motivating principle behind the kingdom of men, isn't it? It's our pride. And so what I want to talk about today, when we look at cultures and how they're developed, and we'll follow through some Ecclesiastes, is basically three things about our culture. Number one, we're going to think about basic survival. Just like I said, I can't do anything of my own. I have to have people that complement my skill sets, and that's been the same from the beginning of history. When we looked last class about Adam and Eve, and we looked at the history of the world, in every case, the world has had to come together to fulfill, mankind has had to come together to fulfill his mission. So let's just start off in Genesis 1. And I want you to think about this mission that we've been charged with. Genesis chapter 1. And this is one, it's interesting because it's one that oftentimes sort of passes us by. We know that we're supposed to replenish the earth, but in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, God created human beings, making them to be like himself. He created them male and female, blessed them and said, "Have many children, so that your descendants will live all over the earth and bring it under their control." I think that's one that we miss often. Part of our task as human beings is to bring the earth under our control. And in our Western civilized society, that's sort of, we've sort of lost the reason for that. We've sort of lost an understanding of why that's necessary. because things are, by and large, in our control. We don't have to worry about, for the most part, walking out back here and being mauled by a bear. We don't have to think twice about how I'm going to get from Little Rock, Arkansas, all the way to Portland, Oregon. I could do that in a matter of hours. When we went on Saturday to the Columbia River, the mouth of the Columbia River, where it enters the Pacific, we crossed over a bridge. We went to the other side. Big deal. And when I got to the other side, I thought, you know, it can't have been that long ago that people had to take a ferry across this river. And I had a discussion with a sister who remembers that her, I think it was her cousin that was the fourth person to drive across that bridge. So it's within our recent history that we have subdued that part of the world. That is part of our task, and we can't do it alone. So what happens is man has to come together. So I want to talk for just a little bit about this concept of then basic survival. I think that's where Solomon goes in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. So let's flip over to Ecclesiastes 4 and muse over a couple of verses in here. And then we will look at how societies are built. Remember, he's just told us that really in the history of the world, everything that he's seen thus far has involved oppression and tyranny. And I think, you know, we looked at some of the conclusions that he drew from that, and they're horrible. It is basically that it would be better that you'd never been born. But of course, we saw from Ecclesiastes chapter 9, that's not what he really thinks. He's saying, if you look at this and the way that history has demonstrated oppression, you would conclude that it would be better never to be born. Of course, then he says a living dog is better than a dead lion. So he's reached this point in his thought over the world as he's observing things. And then one thing you'll see often in Ecclesiastes, he says, I returned and considered. I stepped back. You see these, look for these little phrases in Ecclesiastes. He says, I communed with my own heart. And so as he processes this sort of structure of the world from an experimental perspective, he often comes back from these conclusions he reaches. And so in verse 4, he says, I've also learned why people work so hard to succeed. It is because they envy the things their neighbors have. But it is useless. It is like chasing the wind. They say that a man would be a fool to fold his hands and let himself starve to death. Maybe so, but it is better to have only a little with peace of mind than be busy all the time with both hands trying to catch the wind. I've noticed something else in life that is useless. Here's a man who lives alone. He has no son, no brother, yet he is always working, never satisfied with the wealth he has. For whom is he working so hard and denying himself any pleasure? This is useless too, and a miserable way to live. Two are better than one, because together they can work more effectively. If one of them falls down, the other can help him up. But if someone is alone and falls, it's just too bad, because there is no one to help him. If it is cold, two can sleep together and stay warm. But how can you keep warm by yourself? Two men can resist an attack that would defeat one man alone. A rope made of three cords is hard to break. He goes into a story about the king that rose from poverty to become king, and in the end he became a tyrant just like the guy that was before him. And so he sort of goes back into the unfortunate path of mankind that they normally take, and it's true. You see people, and I've experienced this in my life already. I worked for a really small company that did great things. Everybody worked together. And the partners that owned our firm were very down-to-earth guys. Well, we started to make a lot of money. And I saw these guys begin to compromise their principles. And so I had to quit that job, start another job. But you've maybe seen this in your own life. You know, that your circumstances, people allow their circumstances to affect them. I want to look in Genesis chapter 10. I want to look at one of these stories of tyranny. And it was the first one that we put up there yesterday. So we're going from basic survival now, and I want us to think forward, okay? Beyond just being in a team tribal environment to subdue the earth, to protect each other, to lie together so that we can have heat. You know, this is some very basic human principles, but these are ones that God has established just so we'll be able to survive. And to me, that in and of itself is kind of a faith-boosting idea that built into us and built into our cultural need. It's not really culture yet, but built into our cultural need is God's design. So if we look over at Genesis chapter 10, we'll look real quick at the story of the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel. Have you spent much time thinking about the Tower of Babel lately? Fascinating story. And very relevant to today. Very relevant to today. A wholehearted endorsement for you. Again, I'm no rocket surgeon. Anything that I say, trust me, it is a complete regurgitation of things that I've heard. Complete regurgitation. Maybe pieced together in a different way. I listened to this guy whose name is Rabbi Daniel Lapin, L-A-P-I-N. I wholeheartedly endorse him. I think he's fantastic in terms of how he can open up, especially some of the Hebrew scriptures to us, to understand God's message. And he does a great piece on the Tower of Babel called The Tower of Power. And it's just about an hour long. And I want to mention one other thing. This is a complete aside. I'm sorry to be a little scattered. But I bought it. I bought it from Rabbi Daniel Lapin. I could access it online just like I can access Privileged Planet online or any of these other things. To me, if there's value in something and somebody is selling a DVD or CD like that, I like to support them. Because think about it, in reality, that guy's got to make a living. I feel strongly that way, especially like we really like the artist Sarah Groves. And you can get a lot of her stuff, and you can have somebody burn you a CD, but those people need to eat too. And so I like to think about it when I go buy their CD that, here, maybe that's her lunch, or she can take a friend out to lunch. Anyway, that's a complete aside. Sorry. So the Tower of Power, in the Tower of Power, Rabbi Lapin, he expounds on how Nimrod went about coordinating his civilization. Nimrod's name has to do with catching people, okay? Or it has to do with catching. So it has to do with catching people and grabbing them and using them. And we'll see that that's how Nimrod reigned. And I put him up there at the head of the list of tyrants yesterday. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, right? And one of the things that Nimrod wanted to do in his pride, lo and behold, was to take charge of men. He wanted to impress them into his service, and he wanted to be a tyrant over them. Let's see how that comes out. So in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 5, and we kind of have to get a little bit of background here. In Genesis 10 verse 5, we see that the descendants of Japheth were living in their different tribes and countries, and each group was speaking its own language. And this word for language is, you should have, and if you're the King James Version, it's a tongue. And one of the things that Rabbi Lapin points out is that the tongue is inside your mouth, and it's the sort of the nuances of your language. It's not, I speak English and you speak French. It's, I speak Arkansas English and y'all speak Oregon English, the Queen's English. Okay, so the tongue has to do with, they all had their own accent, basically. In chapter 10, verse 20, we have the descendants of Ham living in their different tribes and countries, each group speaking its own language. And the reason this is important, I don't know if you're like me or maybe you've glossed over this verse in the past, but I never noticed that all these guys were already living according to their different languages. And this is pre-Tower of Babel. And the big deal about the Tower of Babel is what? He confused their languages. Well, they all already pretty well were speaking their own accents, but they did have the same language. They were all able to communicate amongst their various tribes. And then on down in verse 31, just to kind of seal the deal, you have the descendants of Shem living in their different tribes and countries, each group speaking its own language. So let's start off here then in chapter 11 and see what our good friend Nimrod decides to do with these inhabitants of the earth. So at first, the people of the whole world had only one language and used the same words. And as they wandered about in the east, they came to a plain in Babylonia and settled there. And this is the land of Shinar. This is where Nimrod was. This is where he made the great name for himself. And so he is impressing these people. And they say to one another, and really Nimrod, you have to infer, and Rabbi Lappin would say that ancient Jewish wisdom has taught us that Nimrod was behind this whole scheme. They said to one another, come on, let's make bricks and bake them hard. So they had bricks to build with and tar to hold them together. They said, now let's build a city with a tower that reaches the sky so that we can make a name for ourselves and not be scattered all over the earth. And that's in and of itself, you say, well, what's the big deal? And I've always learned, you know, when I was a kid, it was all about, oh, what a presumptive sort of thing to do, to go up and try to make a tower that reaches unto heaven. And in this way, the men were basically saying that they were worthy of being gods themselves. And they had this prideful attitude that they were going to achieve something on their own. Now, in and of itself, the subduing of the earth or the accomplishing of such things and building of buildings, there's nothing in particularly evil in and of itself. So what is going on here in this chapter that is so bad? When Nimrod says, let's make bricks and bake them hard, that should maybe give us a little Bible echo to other places that people were forced to make bricks. Where was that? It was in Egypt, right? So let's flip over to Exodus chapter 1. Keep your finger there in Genesis 11. We'll come back to it. So in Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 through 14, we see, then a new king who knew nothing about Joseph came to power in Egypt. He said to his people, these Israelites are so numerous and strong that they are a threat to us. In case of war, they might join our enemies in order to fight against us, and we might escape from the country. We must find some way to keep them from becoming even more numerous. So the Egyptians put slave drivers over them to crush their spirits with hard labor. The Israelites built the cities of Pithom and Ramses to serve as supply centers for the king. But the more the Egyptians oppressed the Israelites, the more they increased in number, and the farther they spread through the land. The Egyptians came to fear the Israelites and made their lives miserable by forcing them into cruel slavery. They made them work on their building projects, or in making bricks is the Hebrew word behind that, and in their fields, and they had no pity on them. So the Israelites are compressed into this task of making bricks. Back to Genesis chapter 11, we see that the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which those men had built. Now, when you think of the Lord coming down, obviously he doesn't come down in a body necessarily, like you and I would. So what is he doing? He's condescending to these men to see what they're all about. And he says, now then, these are all one people, and they speak one language. This is just the beginning of what they are going to do. Soon they will be able to do anything they want. Now, I thought it was interesting. Now, of course, I have this filter in the back of my mind when Rick presented the other night, and he talked about in the country of South Africa, how many different dialects are there? 11. There's 11 different dialects. And does that make getting business done fairly difficult? It does. What are some good aspects of having different languages, though? Different languages, you know, you think you go to France, and there's a certain degree of individuality that's preserved through different languages. And one of the points that Rabbi Lappin makes is that what Nimrod wanted to do is he wasn't just making bricks, the physical bricks, and kind of like the Egyptians here. You imagine this assembly line where everybody's just a robot and everybody's making bricks. And he had made these individuals into a single sort of organism, one big smear of laborers, right? And so in his tyranny, he had made these people into things that were identical, into just another worker on the line. And he had made this into a very not beautiful type of situation. It is not what God had intended for man to do when he began to come together and form groups so that he could survive. So I think the next thing that we begin to look at is what kind of relationships and how ought we to work together. is sort of where we're leading to. So what does the Lord do? If we look down in verse 7, he says, "Let us go down and mix up their language so that they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. The city was called Babylon because there the Lord mixed up the language of all the people, and from there he scattered them all over the earth. So what Nimrod had done is he'd made this culture where everyone was the same. Everyone had this worked on this big pile of bricks, and they were going to build this tower. And ultimately, who gets the glory in that type of situation? It's Nimrod himself. It's not the individual that's building the bricks. And the tyrant is the one that will succeed in that type of situation. I want us to think about one little piece here in terms of how God looks at these children, and this again is brought out by Rabbi Lappin. In chapter 6 of Genesis, in verse 3, I want you to see what God did with the flood. In the flood, when mankind had spread all over the world and girls were being born, some of the heavenly beings or the sons of God came to the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful, and they took the ones they liked. And the Lord said, "I will not allow people to live forever." And he calls them in this verse, he calls them flesh. He says, "They are flesh, for they are flesh." And he thinks of them as flesh. And this is something that's difficult. Again, we alluded to it yesterday when we looked back, and you'll remember one of the things hopefully I said is you ought to be very offended if you become just a piece of flesh or you're viewed by a person on this earth as just a piece of flesh. And this is very important when you begin to think about how cultures develop. When God looked upon when he looked upon mankind at this time, he saw that they were flesh. And he looked at them basically as a billion pieces of meat. And I think it bears deep consideration that we can be pieces of meat. And that really is all we are. I love to use the analogy that I am 75% water and about 25% dirt. That's what I am. Standing up here today, that is what I am composed of. And I have this visual image when I see roadkill. When I see roadkill, when you see roadkill, and if you're really a sick person, take roadkill and do a time-lapse video of it and see how long it takes to disappear. Are we flesh or are we made in God's image? Okay, and in the Tower of Babel, they had become this group of people that was just heading towards basically what God had just destroyed in Genesis 6. He didn't want flesh. He doesn't want pieces of meat. He doesn't want bricks. He doesn't want every piece of that building to look the same. That is not beautiful to him. That is not beautiful to him, and it's not what he desires of us. So one of the other points that he makes is that when God comes down in Genesis 6 to look at the flood, he comes down with judgment. He comes down to destroy the earth in the flood. When he comes down in Genesis chapter 11, he doesn't call them flesh. He calls them Ben Adam. He calls them the sons of Adam. And that's a significant point, and ancient Jewish wisdom would tell you, as Rabbi Daniel Lappin told me, that it is because he comes down in Genesis chapter 11 in mercy. He doesn't want people to be in a culture that is tyrannical. He wants people to be in a culture that is beautiful. So what does that look like? And I think that's kind of the next step that we go to. If we want to flip back to Ecclesiastes, he wants us to begin working on deeper relationships. And so I just want to pick out a few passages throughout the next couple of chapters that I find to be very helpful. One of the things I like about the book of Ecclesiastes, especially this next little section, which will take us up through the end of chapter 7, is that it's kind of like the Proverbs. It has a very proverbial feel to it. And there's a lot of great little one-liners in here that I call to mind frequently that directly impacts the way that I live. So let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And I'll read verses 8 through 12. Some good thoughts in here. Don't be surprised when you see that the government oppresses the poor and denies them justice and their rights. That is a fact, unfortunately, of existence. Every official is protected by the one over him, and both are protected by still higher officials. Even a king depends on the harvest. If you love money, you will never be satisfied. If you long to be rich, you will never get all you want. It is useless. The richer you are, the more mouths you have to feed. All you gain is the knowledge that you are rich. A working man may or may not have enough to eat, but at least he can get a good night's sleep. A rich man, however, has so much that he stays awake worrying. I love the passage that says, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet." You're taking pleasure in your work. That is what makes, and he's already alluded to that in his personal life, and now he's sort of saying, I'm going to help you guys build a culture from the ground up. Yes, you need to have relationships with other people. Yes, two are better than one. Okay, but now let's talk about how to build these relationships. Let's look over at verse 18. Another one of my favorite ones here is, here's what I've found. The best thing anyone can do is eat and drink and enjoy what he has worked for during the short life that God has given him. This is man's fate. In chapter 6, in verse 3, just a little thing about family here. And consider Solomon's own plight, and we'll come back to this. And, you know, as we've been thinking really heavily about Solomon all this week and the way he must have thought, you know, he gives us a little vision towards what the end of his life was like. I think here he says, a man may have 100 children, chapter 6, verse 3, and live a long time, but no matter how long he lives, if he does not get his share of happiness and does not receive a decent burial, then I say that a baby born dead is better off. I think maybe he sees himself personally here. He's had 1,000 wives. He's spread himself so thin. He's got over 100 children. He could live 1,000 years twice told. He basically is saying, none of my kids even really know me, and there's no way I'll have a decent burial. In verse 7, a man does all his work just to get something to eat, but he never has enough. All a man's labor is for his appetite, yet the belly is not filled. You know, is that the purpose of all your labor? It's sort of a rhetorical question inside a statement there. Again, that would be if your whole purpose was just basic survival. Let's move on into chapter 7, but before we do, I want to read something from Leviticus chapter 18. This is something I think about quite a bit. Okay, so first I want to take a step back. And again, I want to refocus. The class is about faith-boosting evidence in our time for the why of all things. We want to see how God and his culture is a lot better than anything that our world would put forth as being the right way to live. Or alternative lifestyles, if you wish. One thing that that people today, it seems like, have a real hard time with is rules. I know because I'm one of them. We have a real hard time with looking at what God has just simply prescribed as the right way and the wrong way. And people want to say, well, yeah, but, you know, this is a bigger principle and this is a lesser principle, and we're always trying to push these boundaries. So Mari and I got to thinking about that pretty critically, and we have started a little work called God is Good for You. And I think what people don't appreciate in our modern world is that the rules that God has given us are not there to restrict us from doing things that would otherwise be fun. You know, we always think about as a kid, I know you think about, I want to go out and play, but I have to sit here. Or I would love to be able to do this, but I have to be at work. You know, and there's all these rules and restrictions that are laid on us. God's rules and restrictions are not there to keep us from having fun, to keep us from living the good life, to keep us from finding true love or anything like that. God's rules and restrictions are there to keep us from doing the damage that we would naturally do to ourselves. And I think when we begin to trust that the culture that God has designed, the rules that he's laid out for how to build a good culture are much better than what the world has to offer, sort of coming to objectively. This is one of the things that led me to looking at those TED Talks, because people are searching for happiness and trying to figure out why people aren't satisfied. And it's interesting to me that, one phrase that I've heard is, everyone believes from emptiness to everything. Have you ever heard that phrase? Everyone believes from emptiness to everything. An atheist believes in something, and he builds his worldview on that basis. The Christian builds his worldview on the principles of Christ. Which one works better? So, in the absence of God, I heard a story as I was passing through one day on NPR. It said, Western science does itself a disservice by ignoring spirituality. People try to get away from God's principles. People try to escape this prescription. And when they do, they find emptiness, which is basically what they believe in. When you follow a loving God, you find love and you find godly things. The NPR story went on to say, you can be the smartest, strongest, etc., and still not be happy. What kind of proof is this that we don't need spirituality? And what they're saying is that they're concluding themselves that you need some rules. So I want to look at Leviticus 18, because people always have a hard time with, why did God destroy all these people? Why did he allow the Jews to go in and destroy the nations that were there? The women and the children. Why? That seems so heartless. And you could think even about Genesis 6 that way. I submit to you that it will naturally occur. And submit to you that things like a high HIV rate would indicate that people are not doing the right thing. Right? Nature will teach you what is right and what is wrong. And we ought to pay great attention to it. And it is because God has laid it out that way. And Leviticus 18 tells us why these people were destroyed, and it's a tough chapter to read because it's not good. And it shows the kind of relationships that people were developing back then. Verse 6, the Lord gave the following regulations. Do not have sexual intercourse with any of your relatives. Do not disgrace your father by having sex with your mother. You must not disgrace your own mother. Do not disgrace your father by having sex with any of his other wives. Do not have sex with your sister or your stepsister, whether or not she was brought up in the same house with you. Do not have sex with your granddaughter. That would be a disgrace to you. Do not have sex with a half-sister. She, too, is your sister. Do not have sex with an aunt or an aunt, whether she is your father's sister or your mother's sister. Do not have sex with your uncle's wife. She, too, is your aunt. Do not have intercourse with your daughter-in-law or with your brother's wife. Do not have sex with the daughter of or granddaughter of a woman with whom you have had sex. They may be related to you, and that would be incest. Do not take your wife's sister as one of your wives as long as your wife is living. Do not have sex with a woman during her monthly period because she is ritually clean. Do not have sex with another man's wife. That would make you ritually unclean. Do not hand over any of your children to be used in the worship of the god Molech, because that would bring disgrace on the name of God, the Lord. No man is to have sex with another man. God hates that. No man or woman is to have sex with an animal. That perversion makes you ritually unclean. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these acts, for that is how the pagans made themselves unclean, those pagans who lived in the land before you and whom the Lord is driving out so that you can go in. Their actions made the land unclean, and so the Lord is punishing the land and making it reject the people who live there. They did all these disgusting things and made the land unclean, but you must not do them. All of you, whether Israelites or foreigners living with you, must keep the Lord's laws and commands, and then the land will not reject you as it rejected the pagans who lived there before you. I want to think about this word reject, and in the King James, that the land will vomit you out. When we choose things culturally that are awful practices like these, the land itself will vomit you out. It's like it is a physical, visceral reaction of the earth to expel these people. It wasn't a selective go in and kill women and children sort of situation. This was a physical reaction of the earth. You know that whoever does any of these disgusting things will no longer be considered one of God's people. And the Lord said, obey the commands I give and do not follow the practices of the people who lived in the land before you. And do not make yourselves unclean by doing any of these things. I am the Lord your God. You know, these principles, we would say, Well, of course, that applied to an ancient culture that was full of savages and, you know, had no idea how to treat each other and what were appropriate and what were inappropriate relationships. And in a sense, that's what we're talking about. When we're building a culture, there are certain things that you cannot do, or the land physically will vomit you out. I think, is that still relevant today, or is that just an ancient issue? I submit it's very relevant today. And I'll say a complete pet peeve of mine is our modern, and I sound like such an old person now, but we were around the campfire last night singing songs, and I alluded to this because it was fresh on my mind, was we sang some really good songs. But think about music, and think about some of our modern music that's out. And I did a whole series of classes about music with I was supposed to be with Bill Yake. I was very excited because I knew I would just be able to sort of let him talk because he's a lot smarter than me. And he ended up not being able to be there, but I had the benefit of doing some research alongside him. And he had this great slide, and it had a picture, and it says misogyny. Does anybody know the word misogyny? Everybody should know the word misogyny. And underneath it said, hard to spell, easy to practice. Misogyny, I think it's M-Y-S-O-G-Y-N-Y. It's got a lot of Y's. And it's M-I-S-O, misogyny. What does it mean? It means the denigration of women. It means the suppression of women. There's a lot of modern music that is just awful. And I say this especially to the younger amongst us because we're in a very music-rich culture. Everybody's got their iPods. Everybody's always got their earbuds in. You know, the practices that are discussed in Leviticus 18 are not ancient. There are as many animals on the face of this earth walking around in human bodies today as there ever have been. What kind of culture do we want to build? And let's look over now. Let's go on into Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We want pastoral landscapes. We want pastoral landscapes. We want the earth. In the back of your mind, you think, oh, you know, the environmental movement, et cetera. And I work basically alongside the environmental movement, and it says, let nature be. Okay, that sounds good in theory. You can't let nature be. If you let nature be, you will be swallowed up by it. God wants us to have the earth under control. He wants us, and if you think in the back of your mind, what looks better, just a thrown together sort of shack or a nice pastoral landscape with a picket fence? And that brings a natural sense of beauty into our minds. He wants us to develop pastoral landscapes. He wants us to steward the earth in a good way. He wants us to use its resources wisely. You know, I thought back to the Kenites. The Kenites left the pastures better than they found them. They stewarded their land. You know, Mario has a lot of to-do lists for me of things that I have to do to keep our house in order, right? The work, I have come to find, does not do itself. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, I want to stay with this thought of, we're going to look starting in verse 24. I want to stay with this thought of how we develop relationships. And this is probably the most important thing in regards to our culture. Aside from the work we do and the things we build and the music we make, is our relationships. It's built upon, our culture is built upon our relationships. Starting in verse 24, how can anyone discover what life means? It is too deep for us, too hard to understand. But I devoted myself to knowledge and study. I was determined to find wisdom and the answers to my questions and to learn how wicked and foolish stupidity is. I found something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is a snare, whose offers will catch you like a trap or like a net, and her arms around you will hold you like a chain. A man who pleases God can get away, but she will catch the sinner. Yes, said the preacher, I found this out little by little while I was looking for answers. I have looked for other answers, but have found none. I found one man in 1,000, but not one woman. This is all that I have learned. God made us plain and simple, but we have made ourselves very complicated. Man has sought out many inventions. Well, think about relationships here. So he finds more bitter than death the woman whose heart is a snare. I would have to agree. Because that's a tough thing for us guys to escape from. You've probably seen this happen in your own life, hopefully with other people. And then he has this very curious verse, and I really want to bring out, hopefully, this verse. I mused over this verse for about 10 years, trying to understand what it meant. I think I understand what it means finally. And it all hinges upon the word to understand. So in your version, you have this word for find, which is matzah. And it first pops up here in verse 24. And when he says, how can anyone discover what life means? So it's in that phrase there. Or who can find it out, right? He uses this word, who can find it out. So I always looked at this verse 28 is the one I'm talking about, right? One man among 1,000 have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. And it really troubled me because to me this has very much to do with misogyny, with respect of women and how we relate to them as men. Because a lot of what has happened in our human past has been the oppression of women. And that has been a terrible thing that's been wrought upon the earth. Now, please, I'm not making any sort of political or Christadelphian statements with that. That is outside the realm of what I'm addressing. But I knew in my heart of hearts that this man in 1,000 and no women surely couldn't mean that men were like 1 out of 1,000 is good and women are 0 out of 1,000. And the NIV did us a great disservice. The NIV translation did us a great disservice when it translated this, I have found one upright man among 1,000, because the word upright is nowhere to be found in this passage. So it is not, I found one upright man among 1,000 and a woman among all those have I not found. That's a troubling thought to me because I know plenty of wonderful and righteous women. And I couldn't see how Solomon could have come up with this unless maybe it had to do with his wives, but even that was sort of an unsatisfactory thought. So the key lies in this word to find. And in verse 24, it's clearly translated. He says, how can anyone discover what life means? To discover, to understand, to find out. Who can find it out? Who can understand it? Who can make sense of it? In verse 26, the word pops up again. He says, I found something more bitter than death. Again, it's this word matzah, it's to discover, is to understand. He says in verse 27, he says, yes, said the preacher, I found this out little by little while I was looking for answers. I'm trying to understand. And in verse 28, he uses it again. He says, I've looked for other answers but have found none. I have understood none. I have understood one man and 1,000, but not one woman. And it sounds funny, but I really think this is a point he's trying to make, is that the relationships between men and women are beautiful. And he says in a proverb that one of the four most beautiful things he can think of is the way of a man with a maid, when it is appropriately done. And you look back in Leviticus 18 and you see all the horrible ways that people go about it. And in this passage he's saying, I can understand as a man, one man in 1,000. I kind of understand one man in 1,000 of what motivates them and what builds them. But a woman among all those, I do not understand. I think that's borne out that Solomon did not understand women. And he did not treat them and deal with them in the appropriate way. I think that jives to some extent with the way that with the things that John's presenting us. But I welcome your discussion on that point. So he says, God made man upright, and they've sought out many inventions. We have tried every different possible way to live outside of the ways that he has prescribed. We have refused to accept that his prescription is the right one. We refuse to take on face value the commandments that he's given us, the guidelines that he's given us. And in doing so, we fail to realize that he has beautiful things intended for us. You know, I think back to, when I think about the technological advancements that our world has made, a lot of them are really brought forth out of fear. When I think about your modern technology, GPS technology, it was a military invention. And especially in our modern world, most of our inventions are military at their origins. And it's interesting to me that that's really what motivates humans a lot of times, is our fear. Of course, we want to get away from that. And I'd like to close with 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. And I think this is what God wants of us. 1 Peter 2, thinking back to the bricks of the Tower of Babel, the uniform bricks, a big pile of bricks, and the tyrant comes in and says, let's build a tower to heaven. Like I said, it's still a modern-day philosophy that we are somehow going to, by our uniformity, by our sameness, we are going to achieve all the things that we ever needed, and we're still trying to fill this hole with our own devices. God doesn't want bricks. When God had the children of Israel build them an altar, he specifically said, I don't want bricks. He said, I don't want stones that you've cut. He says, I want living stones. I want you to build me an altar out of things that I have made. I want you to build your culture using the principles that I have given you. I don't want you to come up with your own inventions. I want you to appreciate each other. I want you to build the right kind of relationships. And if you do so, you ultimately will find yourself in the midst of a godly culture. Chapter 2 of 1 Peter, starting at verse 1. Rid yourselves then of all evil. No more lying or hypocrisy or jealousy or insulting language. Be like newborn babies, always thirsty for the pure spiritual milk, so that by drinking it, you may grow up and be saved. As the scripture says, you have found out for yourselves how kind the Lord is. Come to the Lord, the living stone rejected by man as worthless, but chosen by God as valuable. Come as living stones, and let yourselves be used in building the spiritual temple, where you will serve as holy priests to offer spiritual and acceptable sacrifices to God through Jesus Christ. For the scripture says, I chose a valuable stone, which I am placing as the cornerstone in Zion, and whoever believes in him will never be disappointed. This stone is of great value for you who believe. But for those who do not believe, the stone which the builders rejected as worthless turned out to be the most important of all. And another scripture says, this is the stone that will make people stumble, the rock that will make them fall. They stumbled because they did not believe in the word. Such was God's will for them. But you are the chosen race, the king's priests, the holy nation, God's own people, chosen to proclaim the wonderful acts of God, who called you out of darkness into his own marvelous light. At one time you were not God's people, but now you are his people. At one time you did not know God's mercy, but now you have received his mercy. And I think the call here to us to be stones, not bricks, the call here to us to be God's people of light, not flesh of darkness, not mere flesh as we saw in Genesis 6, but the sons of Adam, and ultimately to be the sons of God. Let's look over at 1 John chapter 3. See how much the Father has loved us. His love is so great that we are called God's children. And so, in fact, we are.